Elementary, my dear Watson.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems, give me work. The sooner the better.
The game is afoot.
The game is afoot. If you could not recognize those iconic phrases, they were uttered in movies by Detective Sherlock Holmes. Although we should point out, if you are a Sherlock Holmes fan, that Elementary, My Dear Watson, does not appear in any of the stories as they were crafted by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. On the line, we have an attorney, John Birch. John, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
And we will return to what I was just talking about in a moment. But just by way of introduction, if there is such a thing as a United States Supreme Court nerd, it is probably our current guest. When he was Michigan's Solicitor General and commuting to Lansing from Grand Rapids, and correct me if I am wrong, John, you would listen to audio of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court like they were books on tape.
Guilty as charged.
It is guilty as charged. So you have argued, I think, 8 times before the Supreme Court?
Yes, that's correct, Rick.
And perhaps your most unusual client these days is the aforementioned Sherlock Holmes, or I guess to be more specific, the estate of the author, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yes, that's correct. And the estate now is made up primarily of the grandchildren and their spouses and the great-grandchildren of the great Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I've had a chance to talk with a few of them by phone. And it's certainly an interesting case involving the Sherlock Holmes copyright, one that has given me great street credibility with my children.
Well, and me as well. So just explain what the case is. This is about either a book or a collection of short stories?
That's correct. There's a gentleman, his name is Leslie Klinger, who proposes to publish this fall a new collection of Sherlock Holmes stories written by contemporary authors that he recruited. Mm-hmm. And this is actually Yeah, this is the second book that he's done like this. And in the first one, just like anybody else out there who's doing Sherlock Holmes books and movies and TV shows today, paid a royalty, a license agreement fee to the estate. But this time he decided he did not want to do that. And so rather than entering into the licensing contract and paying the fee, he sued the Arthur Conan Doyle estate and asked for a declaration that Sherlock Holmes was in the public domain and that he was free to copy it and therefore had no need for a license.
And there it is not disputed that most of the Sherlock Holmes stories are in fact in the public domain, correct?
That's correct. But the curious thing is that some of them still are under copyright, and maybe
about
that's
10.
Where you were headed. Yeah, we have this old Copyright Act, the 1909 Copyright Act, and it controls all of the works, all the characters that were created before 1978. That's when we have our modern Copyright Act kick into place. And what's curious about the old Copyright Act is that the protection runs from the date of publication rather than from the author's death. And then you end up with this strange circumstance where, in our case, 4 novels and 46 short stories involving Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson are all in the public domain, but the last 10 stories are all still subject to copyright.
And your argument, if I understand it correctly, is that the characters, the use of the characters of Holmes and Watson, are governed by the reality that 10 of these stories are still copyrighted.
That's correct.
Because
the extent that there's elements of the characters that entered the public domain, that's fine. Anybody can use those. But to the extent that there were original elements added in the last 10 stories, and there were many of those, including many of the elements that really made Holmes and Watson, what we now consider them to be, are still protected until the copyright expires on those stories.
Now, your adversaries in this case would and are arguing that basically as long as they stick to the elements of the stories that are in the public domain, they don't owe the estate any money. But your argument, sir, is what?
Well, we actually agree with that. What we say is you can't use any of the elements that are still subject to copyright. The problem came about because the federal courts relieved Mr. Klinger of his duty to come forward with the work and show us what it was, so that we could compare his work against the protected elements of those last 10 stories and decide whether there had been infringement. The court took Klinger at his word that he wasn't using anything from the last 10 stories and basically said to the estate, too bad, we'll give him the declaration of non-infringement, and if he is wrong about that and he does use something from the last 10 stories, then you can sue him for lying.
But
and that's not the way that copyright's supposed to work.
But isn't part of your argument also that the characters of Holmes and Watson evolved over time, that in fact the elements that were, you know, created as part of that evolution in the last 10 stories really cannot be separated from what was created earlier?
Well, in some ways, yes, that's true. To the extent that we've got a character that has dynamically changed over time, the elements that are still subject to copyright, in some cases, may be so intertwined with the character that it'll be impossible not to violate the subsequent copyright by using the character. You know, so, for example, in the last 10 stories, one of the main original features is that the relationship between Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson becomes much more emotionally close, where Watson isn't just the foil, he's not just the roommate, he's not just the comic relief, but he's actually a very close and dear friend to Sherlock Holmes. So to the extent that Mr. Klinger or any of his other authors in these new stories wants to depict the character of Sherlock Holmes as having that close, intimate relationship with Dr. Watson, that's off limits.
Okay, that's very interesting. So what would you like from Mr. Klinger and other people who would like to use the Holmes characters?
We'd like him to come forward with his book and show it to us. And if he can convince us that he's not using anything in those evolved characters as they appear in the last 10 stories, then he's fine. But if he wants to use any of that, if he wants to use the Sherlock Holmes who has the close relationship, the Sherlock Holmes that likes dogs, the Sherlock Holmes that enjoys and interacts with the radio and uses it to help solve crimes, any of the things that appear in the last 10 stories, then he needs to have a license. And, you know, for what we would consider a minor work, like this proposed book, the licensing fee is not great. For the first book, it was $5,000 plus a small royalty in any books that he sold. So it's not like a major motion picture or a television series. The estate has been very reasonable about these things when there is an attempt to use something in the last 10 stories.
Well, let's talk about that. That Sherlock Holmes is certainly a very cinematically popular character. 200 something movies made about Sherlock Holmes. There is a somewhat current series starring Robert Downey Jr. as the detective. What are the implications for those sorts of projects?
Well, it makes it very difficult for the estate when the courts say, yeah, you can go ahead and use the character, even if parts of that character are still protected, without having to show the estate ahead of time the stuff that you're going to use, without letting them see the script for the movie, without letting them see the tapings from the TV show, because then the estate starts to lose control, and it's always in the position of having to sue after the fact. And again, that's not the way copyright is supposed to work. In fact, intellectual property generally, patents, trademarks, copyright, whenever someone comes to court and asks for a declaration of non-infringement, like Mr. Klinger did here, the court always makes the person who authored the new stuff come forward with it and show it to the court so the court can evaluate whether there's infringement or not. And that's what was so radically different about this case. And what makes it significant is not only the rift it created in intellectual property law, but also the fact that so many literary characters are going to fall under the jurisdiction of this old Copyright Act. So when you think about A. Milne and all the Winnie the Pooh characters, you think about many of the Marvel and DC Comics characters that we're seeing in all the movies now, the James Bond books and movies, all of those characters are governed by the 1909 Copyright Act and are going to have this same problem where they're simultaneously in the public domain and still subject to copyright.
As things roll over, does the Conan Doyle estate currently get any kind of compensation from the movies or the Sherlock Holmes television series?
Absolutely. They have licensing agreements with all of the entities that produce those new works.
Mm-hmm. And basically, if Sherlock Holmes uses any type of modern technology, a television, for example, or a telephone, for example, or TV or even the internet, you would argue that that character is covered under the more recent Holmes copyright?
Actually, no, because the copyright in that the estate holds in the Sherlock Holmes characters doesn't apply to new works where new stuff is being used. It only has the copyright in those last 10 stories. Mm. So unless Holmes used a cell phone or the internet in those last 10 stories, which he didn't, there wouldn't be a problem there. You know, the problem comes in that in the first four novels, in the first 46 stories, for example, Sherlock Holmes and the radio never interacted in any significant way. But all of a sudden, the radio pops up in those last 10 stories, and he uses that to help fight crime. So to the extent that someone wanted to publish a story or do a TV show that involved radio technology, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. But TV and the internet are in bounds.
Yes, so long as the movie, the television show as a whole, isn't infringing on any of the elements in those last 10 stories.
I'm going to do a sudden change of topic, although I'm sure you won't be surprised, but we are all waiting to see if the United States Supreme Court will take on one of the same-sex marriage cases. Michigan's currently before the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals awaiting a decision. You are the lead attorney for Utah defending that state's same-sex marriage ban. Do you think we will hear from the Supreme Court this week, and what will they be looking for in a case?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court currently has five different marriage cases in front of it, the one from Utah that you just mentioned, as well as Oklahoma, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Virginia. And it's difficult to predict with any kind of certainty what the U.S. Supreme Court is going to do. But the best guess would seem to be that they'll act on one or more of those petitions this week yet, probably in an order to issue maybe Thursday or Friday. And that those cases will then be set for oral argument this term, and we would have an opinion from the court resolving the marriage issue once and for all, no later than June 30th of next year.
Okay, that is Attorney John Bursch, who has argued eight times before the United States Supreme Court. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. Have a great one.